Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Dolan. Every day, it seems like the headlines are dominated by stories about crime splashed across the front page. Leading the evening news, our daily update is a tally of violence, murder, road rage, sexual assault. Statistics show we have some of the highest rates in the nation of property crime, burglary, robbery, larceny. Governor Susana Martinez and others think we need to invest more in fighting crime, increase punishment for criminals, take more of them off the street, and lock them up longer. Others say we need to treat crime at the root, increasing drug treatment and social programs. For more than 10 years, Jeff Proctor has documented New Mexico's relationship with public safety, police, and the justice system, first at the Albuquerque Journal and later at KRQE Channel 13. This year, he launched the Justice Project with the online nonprofit news site New Mexico In Depth, and he's here today to talk to us about some of his recent work. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
We also have Shira Kaval, a public defender here in Albuquerque. Welcome to the show, Shira.
Thank you.
And Lisa Taracco is a Republican state senator who serves on the Courts, Corrections, and Justice Committee. Thank you for being here, Senator.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff, for a lot of young reporters, doing a stint on the cops and courts beat is a rite of passage. It's something that gives you great newspaper experience, but it is a relentless barrage of sad stories about humans behaving at their absolute worst. You could have easily moved on after a year of doing that to, you know, features and sports or something a little lighter, but you keep doing this. Why?
Well, covering crime is sort of covering the drip pan of society is the way I kind of saw doing that. After some number of years covering the daily detritus of crime and the awful things people do to each other, I started to pay attention to the way systems worked and the way society treated people who'd committed crimes and the people who were invested in different aspects of the system. And I saw that as a really good lens to look at democracy, to look at America, to look at issues of fairness and race and class and those kinds of things.
Shira, do you think that parts of the system that we're talking about here are just not really working at all? I mean, what are the issues that you think are most pressing for the people that you work with in the public defender's office, the people that you see?
The people that we see are people who've been abandoned, many of them at every stage of their life, by the education system, by the healthcare system, by their government, and by the newspapers as well. They're people who the one article that appears in the newspaper about them is the very worst day of their life. And one of the things that it's our job to do is to go to the judges and the prosecutors and the people who have power in the system and force them to see our clients as real human beings, to see that putting them in jail or prison is at best a Band-Aid that's not just going to keep that one person off the street, but that's going to have real serious consequences for that person's future when they get out, for their children, for their family members, for elderly family members that they might be caring for, and make sure that everyone has their eyes open to creative solutions and to really make sure that they see the real people who are in front of them in court.
Lisa, you in the legislature, there was a big focus on crime and public safety this past session. What are some of the top priorities for you right now in terms of what you think? I mean, you've been a prosecutor and a defense attorney. What do you think are the most pressing issues that not just you, but the whole legislature and the whole system should be looking at?
It's a tough one because I'm one member of 112 people, and we all represent different parts of New Mexico, and so we all have very different ideas about things. There was more of an emphasis on crime this last session because it's an election year. Let's just be honest. And so an election year gets different kinds of attention than the other 3 years that were not up for election. I definitely agree that criminal justice is kind of that drip pan, but I think even more so, we're seeing that in Albuquerque, the criminal justice system in Albuquerque is at an all-time low, and fairness and the correct solutions have really hit rock bottom, in my opinion. And I've practiced law for 25 years, so you know, I've got a quarter of a century of practice behind me saying this is the worst that I've ever seen. And it's with sadness that I say that.
We're going to come back and you mentioned politics very honestly, and I appreciate that. We're going to come back to that same topic in a little bit here. Let's talk about one thing specifically from this session, Jeff. The legislature this year made some changes to the bail system, approved that they would go to the voters in November. And they'll have the opportunity, we'll all have the opportunity to approve or reject those. Can you just kind of rehash for us or fill us in on the problems that those changes are supposed to fix?
Yeah. Right now, what we have is a constitution that says that nearly every defendant is bailable. That is based on a constitution from the state of Pennsylvania from the 1700s. So part of it's really created sort of a two-headed problem. On one end, judges don't have the ability to hold people who are sort of predictably dangerous without bail. In other words, if you have access to money, regardless of what the crime it is you've committed, unless it's murder, you can get out if you've got enough money. On the other end, and impacting, by the way, far more people, which is sort of counter to the media narrative we saw. We saw a lot of focus on the preventative detention end and a lot less on the portion of this that's going to affect a lot more people. You've got folks who are sitting in jail who can't afford a $50 bail for a littering fine or for a jaywalking fine or for a
really littering and jaywalking.
Yes, I've done stories about littering, jaywalking, really low level, pretty suspect shoplifting charges, those kinds of things. So what happened was the Supreme Court put together a committee that started studying ways to try to fix this from both ends. And a constitutional amendment was offered, debated, and ultimately changed pretty radically before it was passed and sent on to voters that would attempt to fix both ends of this. In other words, it would give judges the opportunity to hold people if they're proven by clear and convincing evidence that the only way we can get them to come back to court is by holding them until it's time for them to go to court, and they're provably dangerous. And on the other end, we cannot hold people in jail anymore solely because they cannot afford a cash bail.
Listeners, we are talking criminal justice with reporter Jeff Proctor this morning. What do you think of the coverage you see of crime and potential solutions to that problem? What information do you want from the media that you're not getting? Call in now and tell us. The number is 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. Shira, you work with some of these people who are in jail and can't get out. I'm just having a hard time wrapping my brain around the idea that we have people sitting there interminably because they littered or jaywalked. How does this work?
What's supposed to happen is a judge is only supposed to set the bare minimum requirements that are necessary to make sure that the person is not going to be a danger and that they're not going to be a flight risk. Judges don't follow that law. They find it difficult if someone keeps not coming to court to differentiate between people who have problems getting themselves to court and people who are actually trying to flee and escape the jurisdiction of the courts. They don't differentiate between that. And so when you have poor people, homeless people who don't know that they have court dates because they actually literally never got one, it was just a notice was sent to whatever their last address at the MVD. When you have people who have transportation problems, anything like that, who end up picking up bench warrants, then judges just hold them in future cases. And that's not what the law is. It's not what they're supposed to be doing. There's very good social science research that really all it takes to get people like that to court is a phone call the night before. And so that's, at least with me personally, what I try to do with all of my clients. My concern about the bail amendment, and ultimately I don't know what my final position on it is going to be, but my big concern is that's already the law. The law already is that all of these people should be released from jail. You should not be holding anyone solely because they can't afford bail. That is an 18th century thing. I mean, we're talking about the foundings of this country, something that's never really been enforced. And so if judges aren't going to enforce the law now, especially in light of a New Mexico Supreme Court opinion that just told them to do it, why is an amendment to the Constitution going to change that?
Folks, we have a call from Glenn in Hamer Springs. Good morning, Glenn, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, and thank you for having this topic. In 1987, just a few months after I got my two children, I was indicted with 9 felony counts. And with Dimitri Martinez, my co-defendant, in a 3-week federal trial in July 88. And my point would be, if people aren't able to get good attorneys, I had 3 wonderful attorneys, Alice Hector of Albuquerque, and then attorneys from Arizona and California. If you don't get good attorneys who know your case and can fight for you appropriately, if you don't have defense committees like I did, a national defense committee raising $100,000, again, without support and money, you're likely going to end up in jail where I would still be right now.
Thanks, Glenn. I want to let me bring in Lisa Taracco here. Lisa, what you know, you, again, have been on both sides of this as a prosecutor and a defense attorney.
Well, I agree. It's for people who are unjustly accused or overly accused by a zealous prosecution. Definitely the answer is good defense, and our public defender system is grossly underfunded, and it certainly has not been a priority of the governor's to make sure that our public defense system is funded. So there are certainly lots and lots of repercussions in the justice system because the public defender's office is lacking the adequate funds to do what sometimes is absolutely needed for a fair defense for everyone. No question, that's an issue.
Let me say something that Shira won't say, that, you know, we might have this idea, somebody who's never had contact with a public defender might have this idea of this rumpled kind of, you know, loser who's landed at the bottom of the pile and this is the only job they can get. But Shira, you went to Harvard and Columbia.
Yes.
And you probably could have gotten a better job.
I was actually working before I came to Albuquerque at a private criminal defense firm in Palo Alto, California. I don't like going to someone and saying, oh, it's the worst day of your life. Give me all your money. I mean, that's not how the criminal justice system should work. It should work with public defenders who are well-funded, who have the funding to get the experts that they need to debunk, you know, forensic, and I'm going to use air quotes even though I'm on the radio, science, to really make sure that they do work in committees. I mean, there's what the caller just said is absolutely right. We can't work by ourselves. One of the things that I absolutely love about the public defender's office in Albuquerque in particular is the other lawyers are tremendously giving of their time. Everyone will brainstorm with your cases, give, you know, advice based on the cases that they've done. But, you know, all of it comes together. It's not just about having good, well-funded attorneys. The bail system is incredibly important. In this, again, really good, strong social science research that shows that if you control for everything else, if someone's in jail, they're much more likely to be convicted than if they're out of jail. And that's for a whole variety of reasons. It's very hard for us to work with our clients, to find out what happened, to interview witnesses when our clients are a half an hour away up on the mesa in jail. It's very hard. You know, we go to the jail to see our clients, and some clients cannot handle it. They're just mentally, I mean, imagine being in some of the pods at the jail. People are just all together. I mean, you have to be on guard all of the time.
We've seen The Wire.
Surrounded by strangers, right. But how do you really say, I didn't do this, or I did something less serious, or what's about to happen to me is not okay, when the only thing that you can think of is getting out of jail?
We have a call from Sarah in Albuquerque who wants to talk about crime. Good morning, Sarah.
Yes. Thank you for this important show. I just want to mention that all of our crime rate did go up during Mayor Barry's administration. He's been in office for the last 7 years. And our traffic and speeding violations went up right along with auto theft, property crime, and violent crime, and all of this is going on in Albuquerque. And you know what? I want to blame Albuquerque voters, really, because we're the ones that voted for Mayor Barry 2 times, we're the one that choose not to bother to vote for him because we had the lowest voter turnout the last 3 years ago since 1976. And then,
thank you for that point. And, you know, call it the panel here. I wanted to get to the idea that politicians get blamed for crime no matter what connection or power they may have had to it. If crime rates go up during their tenure, they pay the price for it. How much power, Lisa, do you think they actually have? I mean, a mayor in a city like Albuquerque.
Right. Well, the mayor, of course, is the one who hires the chief of police, and the chief of police definitely sets the tenure and the tone for the police department. So I think it depends on what office. Does the district attorney, does the attorney general have a lot of influence over crime? Absolutely. So I think it just kind of depends. But I want to point something else out to the caller, because the caller's saying everything happened when Mayor Barry was elected. You know, I've noticed a different, I'll just say coincidence. And that is that at one point, our jail was so overcrowded, we were paying, the county of Bernalillo was paying millions of dollars to house inmates in different parts of the state and even in Texas. So the courts step in and say, you know, this is wrong. Number one, we can't afford it. We need to empty the jails. And they institute the new rule, which is LR 2400 that we've heard so much about, even if you're not a lawyer. And there's a new case that comes down from the Supreme Court, State of New Mexico versus Brown. And then all of a sudden, the jails are becoming more and more empty. And the Supreme Court is very active about the new bond constitutional amendment. And now that we have a wing that is literally vacant at the Metropolitan Detention Center at the jail, crime is out of control. And cases are getting dropped right and left pursuant to LR 2400. I sit in court and my jaw drops to the floor when certain people are let out because the district attorney didn't provide the second page of the police report or didn't add a certain witness to the witness list. And so my correlation, I don't see that happening, the correlation with Mayor Barry. I see it happening with what the court is doing to empty out the jail. And now that the jail is not full, crime has gone out of control. So I appreciate the discussion about people who are innocent and who are accused, and that's not acceptable. And I appreciate the discussion about people being held in jail who should not be held. But we also have a lot of people who are being held, who are being let go, who should be held because they are dangerous.
Folks, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the relationship between citizens and the criminal justice system. Albuquerque has made changes to the way it prosecutes misconduct by police officers. We want to know if this has increased your trust and confidence in the police and the system. The number is 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. You can also post to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio, or tweet at KUNM News. We'll be right back.
Support comes from UNM Press, presenting Life Story, the Education of an American Journalist. Gerald Moore recalls his work as a reporter at the Albuquerque Journal and as a journalist at Life Magazine. This book and more at unmpress.com.
Support comes from UNM Truman Health Services, presenting the 2016 HIV Walk New Mexico and 5K Run on Sunday, April 17th. Register as a walker or a team at abqpride.com/HIVWalkNM.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm James Barres, author of Awakening Joy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about 10 steps that will put you on the road to real happiness.
Saturday mornings at 6 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland. We are talking with reporter Jeff Proctor, who writes about public safety for the Justice Project at the online news site New Mexico In Depth. We're also here with State Senator Lisa Chiracco, a veteran prosecutor who's now a defense attorney, and Shira Kaval with the Law Office of the Public Defender. Jeff, I want to get back to some of the coverage that you've been doing about this cycle that we're talking about of people in and out of jail and in and out of jail. This also operates with some of the most dangerous criminals out there. And in some really shocking recent cases, we have failed to hold on to folks who probably should not have been on the streets. And the most, you know, the one that comes to everybody's mind is Devon Lyman, who is accused of shooting Officer Daniel Webster. What happened there? Why was he still on the street?
That's a, it sort of depends on who you ask, and it's a long and convoluted answer. He did do 10 years in prison for manslaughter in the early and through the late part of the last decade. He got out. He'd been arrested on suspicion of a couple of more violent crimes. And really, that case sort of became the centerpiece, or one of the centerpieces, for the debate around passing a number of these so-called tough-on-crime laws. What was left out of that debate was the fact that federal agents were buying heroin and firearms from this guy in the 6 weeks before he allegedly shot and killed the police officer. So that was left completely out of the debate. It was never disclosed until I started reporting on it in January.
That was the ATF?
That's right, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
And the Albuquerque Police Department has an agreement with ATF to work together on some stuff?
That's right. We don't know if they were involved in this particular operation, and that's because they refused to not only answer the questions of journalists, but also a sitting member of Congress at the moment. So we don't know what their involvement level was in that particular case. But here's an example of someone who did have a violent track record. Law enforcement knew about him. They knew where he was. He was allegedly committing new crimes, selling large amounts of heroin to undercover agents and a gun to an undercover agent. They did not arrest him. 2.5 weeks after the second of those alleged controlled buys, he, at least according to authorities, shot a police officer.
Lisa, Governor Martinez used Lyman as an example of why three strikes laws should be increased. These laws automatically increase prison sentences of people who've been previously convicted of serious crimes. Manslaughter would qualify for that. Critics say they unfairly apply harsh one-size-fits-all punishments and grossly, expensively inflate the prison population. Do you think three strikes laws are the best way to lock up the most dangerous criminals?
I think that we have the tools now if the police and the prosecutors choose to use them. And so if they don't choose to use them, then we can enact more laws. But I believe they have those tools. And it sounds like, according to Mr. Proctor's investigation, which seems consistent with everything that I have learned, you know, the problem here was not that we didn't have a three strikes law.
Shira, what, I'm assuming that you're going to tell me you don't like this idea.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I agree absolutely that assuming that Jeff's reporting is correct, the jurisdiction that the federal government would have had over him for these sting operations is incredible. Trafficking firearms and guns carries some of the highest sentences in federal courts. One of the problems, we had a caller before who said how important it is to have good defense attorneys. It is equally important to have good prosecutors. One of the problems that I see, at least from my perspective at the public defender's office, is that the prosecutor's office here does not prioritize or focus their time. Kerry Brandenburg came out publicly and said they treat all cases the same. And that absolutely is not good for the people of the state of New Mexico. Is that really what you want from your prosecutor's office? We also were hearing a little bit before about Local Rule 2400, which basically means that my clients shouldn't be languishing in jail for 2, 3, 4 months while we wait to even know what the evidence is against them. In my experience, things are not being dismissed on technicalities. In fact, in the last 6 months, I haven't had cases dismissed, and I haven't been seeing cases dismissed. The cases I had dismissed were ones where on the face, I can think of two specific examples. If you just read the arrest report, it's almost certain that there was an unlawful, unconstitutional search. And what I was missing was the belt tapes, the recording that the police officer made that would be able to demonstrate to a judge that it was an unconstitutional search. That's why my cases were getting dismissed. And the prosecutors shouldn't be focusing on cases where they can read the complaint and know it's going to go nowhere. They should be focusing and trying to figure out who's dangerous and what deserves their most time and resources.
Thank you for that. Let's go to the phones. I want to hear from Alan in Albuquerque. Alan, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to go back to bail issues. Using money bail to keep somebody in jail has been held to be unethical by the American Bar Association and the National Association of Pretrial Services Agencies. Yet our judges regularly set bail amounts that people can't make, and they know they can't make it. And clearly the reason is to keep them in jail. As far as the effect of letting people out of jail, increasing the crime rate, there are studies that show that if you let somebody out of jail the day after they're arrested, they are less likely to reoffend than if they get out the next day. And then less likely, if they, the longer they are in jail, the more likely they are to reoffend when they get out. So I'm guessing, I don't have, that's scientific, that's observable evidence. I'm guessing that the problem with people getting out on LR2-400 is people who are held, who should not have been held, but who have been made dangerous by the length of their incarceration before they got out. They should be released upon conditions that guarantee public safety, where they get supervision, even if they're reporting every day. And that diminishes the risk.
Alan, thank you for that. And you know, there's something that's really jumping out at me right now, Lisa, and I'm going to come to you because there is a political problem with this. Because when we change these rules, when we say we're going to let these people out, then something bad happens. Everybody freaks out and they demand that we change these laws. I mean, there is a public pressure and a public fear. How do you respond to that?
Well, I like what the caller said, especially about the fact that number one priority is to keep people safe. And so these judges should be doing an assessment, a risk assessment. And granted, we're still trying to work on what is an appropriate risk assessment to evaluate, is this person someone who's going to reoffend in a way that will hurt someone else? That needs to be number one priority. I also like what the caller said, and it goes into this man, Lyman, who not only shot a police officer, I mean, he shot and killed Daniel Webster. And he was in for over 10 years. I like what the caller said about the longer you're in, the more likely it is that you're going to commit crimes. Now, he was in for manslaughter, so that's different.
He was convicted of that. He's still just accused of the Webster murder.
Correct. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. But what I want to get to is one of the things that we have pushed on our criminal justice reform subcommittee is halfway houses in New Mexico, because what they do is when people are incarcerated in prison for long periods of time, then they are suddenly, the door is opened and they are put out to the streets and they're somehow supposed to function in a world that is completely different than the way it was 10 years ago. They have absolutely no job skills. They've never owned a smartphone. You know, the world is different and they don't have those kind of social skills to adapt. So we passed, and it was, we passed the legislature unanimously to have halfway houses, which would mandate that people have to spend their last year in a halfway house in the community where they are going to ultimately end up living, where they have to have a job or they have to go to school, but they are constantly being monitored. Unfortunately, that was vetoed by Governor Martinez, but I think it is a much better use of our financial resources and our human resources to help these people succeed when they are released and not help them get back into a life of crime, which is sounds like what ATF was doing with Lyman.
Let me hear a little bit more from some callers. We have Ona on the phone. Ona, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the show. What is it that you want to tell us about the criminal justice?
I appreciate Jeff's raising the issue of systems and what are our systems doing either to help or to hinder this problem. And he indicated that it's beyond the criminal justice system, which we all know is broken and biased incredibly toward people of color. But in addition to that, we need to look at the systems that either offer pathways to opportunity or barriers. And, you know, it's almost 30 years ago that I wrote the book, Kids in Crisis, New Mexico's Other Bomb. And in that, I was predicting the loss to full adult functioning of 40% of New Mexico's children. And when you look at all of the symptoms, like drug use and broken homes and dropouts and so on, you have to look to the roots. And when you look at the roots, one of the things that you see is children and now people being so alienated that they are actually in a state of what is called anomie. And in anomie, there's no reason to do anything or not to do anything. And so crime absolutely grows in that kind of environment. Are we, as New Mexicans, going to address these issues, the root of which is poverty, or are we going to go on and try to fix it after it's broken?
Ona, thank you for that. I want to go to James in Taos now. James, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. I guess you'd say I'm a veteran of conviction. I spent the majority of my young adult life, teenage life, and even now I'm still wrestling with crimes that I've committed. And being from 7 to 34 that I was on paper, set age of 7, I really got a good look at who's inside, who's locked up, what kind of people. And when you see that, you see the recidivism rate, you see the same people come in and out. And these people are really low income, undereducated, and mentally disturbed, but just mental anguish from their lives. And a lot of people don't see that. I've gone to school, I've gone to college, and I've done the things that I've had to do in order to make myself a mentally better person. However, there's a lot of people out there that don't have that option or don't even understand it. And I think that's where a lot of it all stems from, is the lack of education. We've kind of got caught up in a society of cleaning things up and throwing them away and putting them in a trash bag. And that's what our prison systems pretty much have come out to be.
Well, James, what do you think we need to do to, fix that problem?
I really think that we need to get involved with the people that are in there. I've taken all the steps for myself. I went through 5 years of therapy, still in therapy, still on medication, but there's no one addressing, is this guy have PTSD from his mom beating him or his mom leaving him or his dad, whatever. Is this person a child, a product of its own society? And like the lady that was before, she said it's anonymy or something like that. And we alienated. We do. I grew up on, welfare, government cheese, and we were alienated. We didn't have the things that other people have. But that's kind of outside of the point. I think if we really get involved with the people that are incarcerated now and actually try to educate them and force it on them. Because when I was locked up, nobody wanted to go to get their GED. No one gave two darns about it. And once you get that GED, no one could call you stupid. And that's a big thing. You see this literacy program commercials on TV about New Mexico literacy. And a lot of those guys have been locked up, and they didn't know how intelligent, how important they were. They were just put away. They got tattoos. They joined gangs. They got, negativity breeds negativity.
Jeff?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty well settled now that the way America handles incarceration and corrections is not the only way to do it. There was just a piece on 60 Minutes this past week that mirrored some reporting done by the Marshall Project that looked at the way the German system handles incarceration, and it just couldn't be more different than what we do here. Prisons in Germany don't look like prisons look here. They actually take an approach to corrections, true corrections. Like, that's what we're supposed to be doing in New Mexico, but those things cost money. And there's not a really powerful lobby for those kind of interests in anywhere in America, really. And we've also kind of turned over our corrections industry to private industry. And they don't have the same interests that a duly elected government by people do. So there are other ways to approach what the caller was just talking about in terms of folks who have broken laws and do have to pay a debt back to society. But we need to be having a conversation about what we're actually doing with folks while they're inside.
That's a really good point about this not being a powerful lobby. It's a deeply unsympathetic group of people. And I just want to go over one more time your point about the increase in control of private corporations over corrections and how it is not in their corporate best interest. It is not necessarily follow along with their duties to their shareholders to fix people and not have their customers return. That's a really cold thing to say, but
it's also incredibly difficult for the public to scrutinize the work of private corporations that are in the corrections business. They routinely and regularly deny public records requests. We're not allowed to go in and look around in the same way that we can in the facility in Santa Fe. So we don't really know exactly what it is they're doing because they hold themselves apart from the system in that way.
We have a caller on the line, Jared, who works in security. Jared, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call, and good morning. I just want to reiterate, you guys are kind of hitting on the right now with talking about for-profit prisons in this country. I've worked in cities all across the United States. I've been in the security industry for over 10 years. Part of my job is to understand and comprehend really what crime I'm dealing with in each area that I work. Obviously, from a sales standpoint, you need to know about the crime that you're getting yourself into when you talk to customers. And with Albuquerque, I really want to reiterate what another caller had pointed out, is really our child abuse in this city, in this state, overall is really high. And you can look at the poverty rate, and in most cities that I've ever worked in, when you have a system where people, typically your first offense is a small drug charge, something minor, when they get put into the system, they're put in with other prisoners, if you will, or people have been institutionalized that have been in there a lot longer times. And for those long times they've been in there, they develop habits and other peers that are negative and that have violent crime history and that are in gangs. And they peer this one to the new peer who just came into the prison, you know, for a minor drug offense, if you will. Maybe this kid had made one bad decision and he got thrown into this. And then basically moving forward, this is really his world of escape.
Yeah, it's like graduate school for criminals. You know, you go to prison to learn how to be a better criminal.
Exactly. And I just feel like that, you know, a lot of people want to solve the issue by locking more people up and locking them up for almost all these offenses. And yes, there are violent offenders that need to be locked up. But I really think that's a combination of poverty, child abuse rates, and also the war on drugs. I think that's a huge issue. You know, I have family members that have had addiction in the past, and we were able to treat them in a better way without institutionalizing them and getting them on their feet versus putting them in that negative wormhole, if you will. And I just want to say that, you know, there are a lot of repeat offenders that get treated as, you know, even worse because they got caught with the drug again. And then now they're looked at and they get put heavier sentences. And obviously, eventually, these are just going to become negative to society.
Thank you so much for that point. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We need to take a quick break. We all want to live in a safer community, and we have a lot of ideas about how to make that happen. And then there's politics. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some of the political challenges and political abuse of this issue. We want to know what you think. So call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866 or toll free 877-899-5866. If you're listening online, you can email us callinshow@kunm.org. Post to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio. We're looking at it right now. Or tweet @KUNM News. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Alliance Française, with small, friendly, conversational French classes forming now. All levels, beginners French for travelers and French for children. Details at 872-9288 or afabq.com. Hank the Truck had served so well, hauled everything, helped friends to move, went on adventures in the mountains. Basically, Hank had become a longtime friend. But when at last Hank couldn't run anymore, his owner decided in one last magnanimous gesture to make Hank's end have meaning. She donated Hank where his essence lives on in another friend, KUNM. You too can help two friends. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland, and I am here with criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor, State Senator Lisa Tirocco, and public defender Shira Kival. We wanted to move into talking a little bit about politics, and we happen to have on the phone Raul Torres, who is running for district attorney here in Bernalillo County. Welcome to the show, Raul.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for having the program. I think it's really important to give people an opportunity to really discuss some of these complicated issues. I think your panelists and the callers have identified a lot of the really important structural issues that we need to take on in reforming this system. And I think we have an opportunity to modernize the criminal justice system and recognize that what we've been doing simply hasn't worked. I think what we need to do is focus on solutions. And the first thing is to start looking at communities around the country where they've had a real success in driving down crime rates. And they've done that in the district attorney's office in Manhattan and Seattle and San Francisco and other places by employing new strategies and new tactics, specifically using data to identify and prioritize the most violent, the most dangerous offenders. That's something that, frankly, we don't have the capacity in Bernalillo County, and we don't have the capacity in the district attorney's office right now, but we should. Right now, the real issue is a failure to prioritize the most violent and the most dangerous. The second thing we need to do,
But, Raul, let me ask you, how would you change that if you were the DA?
So what we need to do is start building the database and information infrastructure. There's a lack of communication, frankly, between the police department and the district attorney's office in terms of establishing who are the top priorities, who are the people that are driving crime, who are the people that have a history in this community of committing violent crime and have access to weapons. Right now, there's no objective system for evaluating those cases, right? We let cases come in. They're assigned to prosecutors based on the type of crime that they've committed rather than the type of offense or the type of offender who are coming through the door. So you need to reorganize the office around the nature and seriousness of the offender, not the type of crime. That's the first step.
Jeff?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say is there have been attempts at the law enforcement level to identify these, you know, so-called worst of the worst and repeat offenders. We had a thing here that was called the Repeat Offender Project, known as the ROPE Team within the Albuquerque Police Department. That worked out very badly. That was a team that was sort of rife and rampant with abuses that caused a huge number of the constitutional rights violations that led to the situation we have with the police department right now, which is that they're under a federal consent decree. So there have been some attempts there. I wanted to say, too, in terms of prioritizing at the district attorney's office, my reporting through the years has shown that there were probably somewhere around 40% too many cases indicted for a huge number of years. That number is way down now. That's part of the reason we have fewer people in the jail. Another one of the reasons we have fewer people in the jail is APD is down 250 officers. So LR2 400 may have had an impact. The Brown decision may have had something of an impact. But we've also got a situation now where fewer cases are being indicted and fewer people are being arrested because we have fewer police officers. So I just wanted to kind of circle back to that. Furthermore, the jail is also under federal rule now. They're not allowed to have any more than 1,850 people. So this huge reduction in the jail population is more complicated than a Supreme Court rule and a Supreme Court decision.
Raul, do we still have you there?
Yes.
What do you think of what Jeff just said?
Oh, I think Jeff makes an excellent point. I mean, we're not going to be able to drive crime down if we don't have a police force that is up to sort of adequate capacity. And I also think he makes an excellent point that we need to exercise a lot more discretion on the front end, which is a point that the panelist from the Public Defender's Office makes. Not all of these crimes should be treated the same. Some of these folks have mental health issues. They have chronic addiction issues. And we need to be willing to get out into the community and take proactive steps to provide treatment and alternatives to incarceration before they commit crimes, not just waiting for them after they enter the criminal justice system.
Raul, thank you for calling in and talking to us a little bit about the role of the district attorney's office in this. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
We also have Bruce on the phone. Bruce is an addiction doctor. Welcome to the show, Bruce. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'm calling up because there's a big problem with the drug courts, especially in Bernalillo County. The drug courts are supposed to offer treatment rather than incarceration for nonviolent offenses where people have drug addiction. But the drug courts have continuously refused to provide proper treatment, to even allow proper treatment. People with an opiate addiction should be on methadone or buprenorphine. And even though the National Drug Court Association and all medical authorities say this is the correct treatment, the judges somehow feel they can ignore medical expertise and practice medicine without any real knowledge. And the problem is people with opiate addiction, which is a huge problem, as everyone knows, are not getting correct treatment in the drug courts, and they're essentially being set up to relapse and to wind up wasting their time and our money sitting in prisons and jails, and it's been very frustrating for people who are advocates for people with drug problems in this state.
Thank you for pointing that out, Shira. Just briefly, you're nodding your head.
I am nodding my head. The drug courts at least in the district court in Bernalillo County, are run by probation and parole. There's also a separate court that's a DWI court that's intended to be for people with, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh DWIs, people with serious addiction problems. And they're run very differently. The drug court really is much more of a law and order type court. And it has these rules that you can't get to phase two if you're using anything like Suboxone or methadone. The DWI court they don't like that as a solution, but they're much more focused on really trying to have a serious recovery and prevent future crime. One of the questions that we need to ask as a society is, what's our goal? What do we want to do? And the reporting that's happened in the last year about opiate addiction and about the serious health toll that it's taking on this country makes very clear that having Suboxone and methadone is an option. That's how you save lives. So that's the first goal, I think, needs to be saving lives. They also prevent crime, which I think is everybody's goal here as well. So it's really important to be thinking about that. The judges themselves in Bernalillo County, I have found, are very responsive to people being on Suboxone and methadone. If they're not in the drug court program, they don't order my clients to get off of methadone and Suboxone, which is really great. It really gives my clients the opportunity to work with their healthcare providers and do what's best for them. Another thing that I want to point out.
Let me jump in, because I want to take this drug issue and connect it to politics with the war on drugs. You know, a few weeks ago, we heard some really, well, somewhat surprising quotes from Nixon advisor and former Santa Fe resident John Ehrlichman, who said quite clearly that the Nixon administration made up the war on drugs to target hippies and African Americans. Jeff, people like Radley Balko say almost 50 years later, this political game of Nixon's has cost us a fortune in our tax dollars and totally screwed up the relationship between the police and the public and clogged our prison system. In your reporting, how have you seen politics disrupting the criminal justice system?
First of all, I would say I would take with a healthy dose of salt anything John Ehrlichman says. In a bunch of different ways, how politics and sort of the way we deal with addiction and mental illness, we deal with those in a very moral and sort of law and order kind of fashion instead of dealing with them as the public health crisis that they are at this time. Addiction has essentially been criminalized. And in terms of the way that's interacted with the things I've covered, what we saw here with something everyone's probably familiar with who's listening to your show is this massive wave of police shooting cases here in Albuquerque. It was a little bit of a different narrative than what we saw in other parts of the country where race had quite a bit to do with what was going on there. Here, the majority of the folks who have been shot and killed by the police were folks who were living with mental illness and people who were probably also dealing with some sort of an addiction issue. And really, the concerns I've heard both and reported on, both from rank-and-file law enforcement officers and the families of men who've been shot by the police here, is that we've asked law enforcement officers to go deal with a problem that they're just not equipped to deal with. When you are a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And when what you're trained to do is fight crime and you're sent into a man's home who's clearly in the middle of a mental health crisis and he's holding a butter spreader and you just don't have the tools to deal with those kinds of things, that's how we've wound up in the situation that we've wound up in. So that's when you politicize public safety in the way that we've seen public safety and the criminal justice system politicized here, these are the kinds of problems that result from that.
And we see the focus on, as Lisa said at the beginning of the show, we see the focus on public safety in an election year because both parties want to use it as a tool, a weapon against each other. And the hate crimes, the suggestion that we add police officers to the hate crimes statute, Jeff, what did you think of that?
Well, what I think of it doesn't matter tremendously, although it's when you talk about a case like Daniel Webster's case and you use that as an example, that wouldn't have done anything to prevent that shooting. I mean, that's something that you might look at doing after the fact. Plus, that's just not the sort of thing that the hate crime statute is meant for. Lyman did not allegedly kill Webster because he was a cop. He allegedly killed him because he didn't want to go to jail. There wasn't a specific targeting of the sort that we've used hate crimes laws for in this country.
I want to take one last caller before we go. Chris in Santa Fe. Welcome to the show, Chris. Good morning.
Well, good morning. I have a comment first on Jeff Proctor's recent excellent piece on Jeanette Anaya's killing up here in Santa Fe. He focused on that on the way that case was investigated by the grand jury and the police. There's one part that he didn't focus on, which is very central, which is that the Santa Fe police pursuit policy is different from the state police pursuit policy, and that difference led directly into the killing of Jeanette Anaya.
Chris, I'm gonna interrupt. Oh, no, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Pardon?
Finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
So the problem is from my investigation of it is that this problem is not local to Santa Fe and the state police. It is statewide. And my question is, how could we get consistent legal policies, especially pursuit and use of force policies, across our state?
Chris, thank you for that. We only have a few minutes left in the show, but Jeff, I think the really interesting point here is that even though the Albuquerque Police Department changed or Albuquerque changed the way it investigates police shootings, other jurisdictions in New Mexico like Santa Fe have not done that. And that's what your big story in the Santa Fe Reporter and on New Mexico in depth highlighted. You know, how big of a problem is that?
Well, it's a community trust problem as much as anything else. I mean, this is to briefly summarize, what I reported on was the use of so-called investigative grand juries to review police shooting cases. What folks don't know about those is it's a grand jury without any power or teeth whatsoever. The grand jury couldn't have indicted the police officer in that case, even if it had wanted to. That's not the question that was before it. So that's an operation that takes place with the door closed. No one's allowed in to sort of see how that works. And what comes out the other end of a situation like that is this was a justified shooting. Everyone had seen the video of that shooting, and a lot of people had very different opinions about what happened. So that disconnect is something that really has led to some pretty substantial community mistrust.
Yeah, ultimately, when you see what you believe is real misconduct by an officer on a video, you know, and then nothing happens, how do you trust police officers? Lisa, we only have a couple of minutes left. Just briefly here, what are you working on in the legislature? What's coming down the pike that you're working on in the Courts, Corrections, and Justice Committee or in some of your subcommittees, some of your personal projects?
We're trying to focus more on preventing crime rather than the punishment. And I just want to correct something that was said earlier. My earlier comment about it was an election year, that was just for punishment. You know, we're trying to focus on getting to the root causes like behavioral health, problems in CYFD, how we treat foster children, things like that. That's at least the goal of the subcommittee that I'm on.
Thank you for that. And Lisa, thank you so much, Senator, for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. Shira Kaval, what is coming up next for you guys in the Public Defender's Office?
Well, let me tell you about just a couple real concrete problems. One, there is nowhere to go if you are on psychotropic medication for mental health and you also have addiction problems. There's nowhere.
We have about 5 seconds.
Okay. And then one is people getting out of jail after they've been arrested, after 10 days have passed, if they haven't gone to grand jury or preliminary hearing. It's just not happening. There are a couple people every day who are getting held in longer than they should.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Shira Kaval. Jeff Proctor, we didn't get to nearly, you know, half of the things you've written about lately. I want everyone to go see your work on New Mexico and indepth.com. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for joining us today on the KUNM Call-In Show. Thank you to our guests. We've posted links to the information we discussed today at KUNM.org. If you missed any of this, you can go and listen to it there, and you can leave us comments. Thanks to Jefferson White, our engineer. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Anna Landy assisted with production. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland.